think I'm going to have in my head these words, Billy wants a doll. Billy wants a doll. Wasn't that grating? But I wonder how many of us have words like that in our head from childhood, where we were shamed or ridiculed or not accepted or not welcomed. And they dwell in us, and they still have life in us. And our work here at this church is to help soothe that anxiety and comfort those wounds and heal that, so those words no longer have power in us. And in a sense, it's ironic or fortuitous that the sermon is somewhat about that, about healing and protecting our minds. This is the third sermon on the seven deadly sins. And I suspect some of you still might be asking, what is a Unitarian Universalist church doing with the seven deadly sins? Clearly, one would think, conservative Christian bent. But as we have discovered, the seven deadly sins were not about behavior, but they were about protecting something within our minds, protecting something within our imaginations. And that when thoughts of pride and thoughts of greed, and when these thoughts began to emerge from our mind, it was a method to engage these thoughts as they were occurring so that they would be defeated within our minds before they were ever expressed as behaviors. So they would be protecting ourselves. And that surprised me when I first learned that. Because now I have to think about, can I even identify a prideful thought as it's happening? Or do I feel I have a right to that prideful thought? Can I even identify a thought that's birthed out of a sense of greed? Can I even identify it, really, much less have a conflict with it and defeat it? The same with gluttony, the same with wrath, the same with anger. I talked to this one person, they say they have a right to their rage no matter how it affects other people because it's who they are. So they have a right to what we would consider are at least one of the deadly sins. In the last sermon we talked about, we were going to turn to the work of William Ellery Channing. William Ellery Channing was one of the founders of our country, of Unitarianism, and he was the one who had the courage when the two Christian churches were fighting, one a more conservative Calvinistic church who was strong with damnation and original sin, and then there was an aspect of a more liberal, more kinder, more gentler church, which Channing represented, but yet they were in one church. But there came a time when they divided, and William Ellery Channing stood up and said, no, this is who we are as Unitarians. And in that, that church did split. And to really understand William Ellery Channing's work, in which we're going to focus on the reading we read today, Spiritual Freedom, because he's also talking about something that protects our mind, that protects our spiritual well-being. And in his work, Spiritual Freedom, before we can get there, I've asked the question, what is it he's protecting? What is it about his mind? What is it about his experience in life is he protecting? And I think I found it. When he was 15 years old, he was at Harvard University and had this experience. A unique impact came upon his reading over Hutchison under the willows near Judge Dana's office. Suddenly he was seized by mystical feelings of joy and peace and love, and his eyes followed Hutchison's assertions that the human capacity was for unselfish affection, Channing claimed that there burst upon him at that moment a view of dignity of human nature that would forever be the master and light for the rest of his life. What happened to William Ellery Channing was that he had this mystical experience where he was grasped, where he was enthralled by the sense of love and compassion and joy. And it was a pure experience, and it was a good experience. And this experience was going to be the guide for the rest of his life as he ministered and as he moved throughout. That was a problem in his day and age. You would think an experience such as that would be a wonderful experience and be affirmed. No, that was a problem. And this was the problem.
The mic was rubbing on the coat.
So this was the problem. He lived in a religious environment that said at the core of who you are was evil, was sinful, and you needed an external source to save you, to make you feel okay. And that external source was recorded in a particular book. Well, he had a double problem. He had this mystical experience from a man named Hutchinson and not from the sacred Bible. And it was a pure experience of love in which he realized the innate goodness within himself. And he lived in a community that would say to him, because of their belief systems, well, you can't have that experience. That experience is not true. Even though he had that experience. And I got to thinking about that. How many of us have ever had an experience where we knew to be true, or how many of us have ever tried to communicate something about who we are in a relationship, and the feedback we got was, well, that can't be true. You can't have that thought. You can't have that experience. And then the person saying that to you would relate to you as if you never had that experience, or never had that thought, or never had that idea, or that's not true, or that's not real about you. And they're relating to you as if you've never had that experience. But that experience is turning the course of your whole life, and people are relating to you as if it's not true and denying that you've ever had it. Well, that's the environment that he was in. And it also occurred to me, how many of us have had powerful experiences, and because of that experience, we had the idea my life would be forever different. This experience is going to turn my life in a direction where I will be my best self, where I will be able to commit to my values and actualize my values. And this experience is a tremendous experience. Only to find 2 weeks later, I'm back to my old self, and that new self has taken a back seat. Maybe not. How many of us have ever had that experience? How many times have we had that experience might be the question. That we had a wonderful experience, but as we live in our life, we live our lives out, that experience gets diminished and loses its power. One thing I've learned and have shared here in studying family systems, that if you have a family system and say it's somewhat a dysfunctional family system, and one person in that family system decides that they want to change and turn the tide of their life so that it's healthier, that the rest of that system will pull that person back so they don't move toward health, so that they will stay in that toxic environment. The same happens with experiences like these. We have a liberating experience that's going to free us from some difficulty, from some addiction, from some habit, from some negative way of thinking, and we're going to be free of it. But what we don't realize, we're in a system that might pull us back so we don't change at all. So that we stay there. And then what happens? We begin to think negative about ourselves. Then I'll actualize that voice. Billy wants it all. Billy wants it all. Gregory's no good. Gregory's no good. Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? Those kind of voices come into our head and we don't change. And we go back to our old way and we live with the fact that I know a better way, but I'm not doing it. What William Ellery Channing is doing is he is saying there is a way to protect those experiences so that they maintain their power, so that they can be guides for you as you move through life. And that's what he's talking about in his section on spiritual freedom. And he begins spiritual freedom as any good student would begin. If you've written a paper, he begins his work on spiritual freedom by writing a problem statement. I don't know if you've ever been in graduate school or if you've ever been in a place where you've got to write a problem statement. They're not so easy to write. Because if your problem statement is not good enough, and believe me, I've handed in 5, 6, 10, 20, and got it back. Not good enough until you get it right. Because your problem statement justifies what you're going to say afterward. And in your problem statement, everything you say afterward is related to your problem statement. So when William Ellery Channing is writing his problem statement in relationship to what we're talking about today, I thought, well, isn't that interesting? He's writing a problem statement. He doesn't say, this is my problem statement. He just starts writing. But I thought, he's writing a problem statement. And that statement goes like this. Somehow we find ourselves, from our birth, in difficulty and an allurement to other than who we are, in a world where wrongdoing is often gainful. This is 1820. Things haven't changed too much. And duty is rough and perilous. To follow the power of that experience is going to be difficult, is going to be rough, it's going to be perilous. Where many vices oppose the dictates of the inward monitor, where the body presses as a weight upon the mind and matter, and by its perpetual agency on the senses, becomes a barrier between us and the spiritual world. We are in the midst of influences which menace the intellect and heart, and to be free we must withstand and conquer these. This morning, so we define, well, what is menacing to our souls? What is menacing to our psyche that would move me away from having these powerful experiences be directors in my life? So I was reading, it was usually a mistake, sometimes it's not a mistake, to read the news before church. But I was reading the news before church and came across an article where water in Chile has been privatized. And there's a village that has been there for a long, long time, hundreds of years. And in this village is in the desert, except for from this mountain comes this water and forms this oasis. And these people have lived off of the water in this oasis. And that because of the water is privatized, a mining company could get the water and actually dry up the water, use the water. Heavy metals are in the water, and sometimes it's not good, sometimes it moves to a trickle. And these people have no rights. And some economists are saying this is the most efficient way, this is the most wonderful way to use natural resources because it's efficient, economically efficient. And so they are talk in those terms. So when I read that, my mind is listening to Larry! So when I'm reading that, and I know the problems with privatizing public goods. I know the problem with privatizing natural resources. I understand the problems. My mind is menaced. My sense of well-being is threatened when I do that. And this is what Channing is talking about, that there are things that go on in the world that are wrongful things where people profit from that would cause us such disruption in ourselves, we would not be, we would lose our capacity to listen to our inward monitor. And I have to think, well, what is that? What is this inward monitor? And more importantly for today, where does the activity of this inward monitor take place within my mind? This is what's important today. Where does this take place in my mind? I call that mind free, which masters the senses and protects itself against animal appetites and against pleasure and pain in comparison to its own energy, which penetrates beneath the body and recognizes its own reality. I call that mind free, which is aware of what's going on within itself and creates its own reality. That our minds create our own reality. And I call that mind free that does that. If I'm responding to what's going on in Chile, and I have a reaction to that, and then I go study that, and then I react to it, and then I preach about it, and then create a seminar about privatizing public goods, which on the surface might all look like a good thing. Have I abandoned myself, according to Channing? Have I become a reaction to that which I consider evil or harmful? And now I am a reaction to that, but I'm not really my truest self. Christopher Lash, a social historian, says that we have been for thousands of years forming our egos, forming the principles which organize our lives and how we're going to engage the world and how we're going to understand ourselves. The ego says we have been forming our egos in a society that's patriarchal and that is father dominant, and that has become the father dominant has become the way of life in our head in which we organize and have ideal images. And he says, however, because we now live in an absent father society, that our ego is now being formed in terms of a social collectivism by television, by media, by gangs, by sports figures, by many other things, and that our ego, it gets connected to the larger culture, and that's how our ego is formed, so that's how our ego is organized, so that's how we organize our inner world, and we're always outward directed. So our ego looks this way, outward, for organization, sense, and meaning. William Ellery Channing is saying, no, you must turn this way. You must look inwardly to where the inward monitor dwells and nurture that area to build your own reality, to strengthen your own reality, so that when you turn around, you're engaging the world, you're not conforming to the world. And that's a major difference. We talked last week about the imagination and how Evagrius talked about the seven deadly sins, and that what he was protecting was a part of the imagination that through across religions alike, they would use terms such as these to describe that. The perfect nature, the heavenly witness, the transpersonal self, the archetype, the kind superego, the philosopher's angel, the perfect nature, Sophia. What they're all talking about is a place in our imagination that William Ellery Channing had an experience with when he was 15. It's a place of pure love. It's a place of pure compassion that is not contaminated by this external world. But what happens when I'm only oriented to the external world? I don't have access to this part of myself. I don't have access to what drove William Ellery Channing in his ministry and in his life to be a compassionate and loving person, to be for social reform, and to be for somebody who was, if you read his sermons on labor, for the laborer, even then, talking about labor and wealth. You don't have what I call, it's an odd thing, so it's an exercise before I can say I call it, I should probably say what it is, might be helpful, that in your imagination, if you were to turn completely around in the 360-degree circle, and the best that you can observe everything that is in you, you will find more than likely places where the experience of love occurs, where the experience of compassion occurs, where the experience of anger occurs, where the experience of disgust, despair, sorrow. When we do that, we alert ourselves that we are not anchored in this experience that Channing had and that others have had. Because until we can turn the full 360-degree circle, until we can turn that full circle and always have the sense of love, we will not respond to this world with a sense of pure love and compassion until we have that experience ourselves. And that's what Channing was saying. We have talked about before Christopher Bolas, who says when this part of us collapses, our inner world becomes a fascism. which supports a fascist state. We've talked about Sufi spirituality and the year 1200, where this particular Sufi said, if this world collapses and you don't have access to your perfect nature, to the philosopher's angel, there becomes a spiritual imperialism where somebody will try to impose on other people their particular theology, their religion, their spirituality. So we have through time descriptions of when this part of our imagination collapses, what happens is a sense of oppression to ourselves and to our community at large. And when I'm reading Christopher Lash saying our ego is now formed by this outward cultural structure, is that where we are as a culture? Does our culture function in a way that collapses this part, that builds its own reality, that experiences that pure sense of love so that we can respond to one another and care for one another? Is that what Channing is saying? You've got to jealously guard your mind. You've got to listen to the inward monitor. You've got to listen to that inner oracle. You've got to have access to that in order to be healthy psychologically and spiritually in this world. His words written in 1820 are pertinent for today. Why I think that they are so important is this. If we are to genuinely love one another, if we are to have the capacity to sense being loved, to sense being cared for, if we are to have the capacity to recognize that you are important to this community, to know and to feel the importance you have to this community, if we don't have this part of ourselves alive and well, we lose the capacity to love and to care in a genuine way, an unselfish way. We also lose the capacity to know when we are loved and to know when we are cared for. Helen and I were talking the other day, and sometimes I might say something like, do you love me or something? You know, like any insecure man might do. And she started singing the song from Fiddler on the Roof. Do I love you? 24 hours a day, I do this and I do that. I do this and I do that. Am I available to feel her love for me? That is just as important as it is to love, to feel being cared for. Channing is telling us, guard our minds and our spirits with a vigorous, with an intensity. Because if we don't, we will lose the capacity to love, to commit to community, to commit to our values, to commit to others, and to feel the commitment others have to us. This is what we're up to today. To guard jealously and to invigorate and to nurture that part of ourselves that can feel love and that can love.